There's crispy. And then there's crispy-er. Try our new and improved Tyson Crispy Chicken Strips. Crispy just got crispy-er.
Three people in the same location. Welcome to an old school version of College Football Live. Matt Schick along with Tom Luganville and Mike Golic Jr. We are mere hours away from the early signing period. We will let you know and educate you on the storylines you need to know for that endeavor, again beginning on Wednesday. But there are some coaches not only trying to cobble together recruiting classes, but also trying to win national championships, like the reigning national champion Clemson Tigers, showing them proper respect here by giving them the first B-roll. Tigers making their fifth straight playoff appearance. Head coach Dabo Swinney hasn't been shy about the lack of respect or attention his team has received and being ranked number three despite the success at Field of the Fire.
This team has been portrayed all year so inaccurately. And the story, instead of who we are and how we play, the story's been about we played a close game, we don't play anybody, which is total disrespectful for other teams. We don't play anybody. Oh, and Trevor threw a couple interceptions. That's been the story.
Yeah, just all year kind of been, you know, taking the back seat, I think, a little bit, which is, you know, it's whatever. I mean, I think that's just how, you know, the season's gone, but I don't think we've, you know, it's been worked out perfect, though. We've been in the back seat, you know, under the radar, and, you know, this is the time now we get to actually prove ourselves.
Let's add fuel to the fire. We just got to come out here and execute. And, I mean, it's definitely crazy to think that we're underdogs when we have 128 straight. But, I mean, it's just all God's plan. So it just gives us fuel to add to our fire.
Well, does this look like an underdog to you? Since 2015, they've been as dominant as any program in the country. 68-4, the best in the FBS, five straight conference titles, most importantly, playoff success, making the playoff each of the last 5 years, winning two national championships in that span. I should remind you, they are 2-point favorites against Ohio State. Does he have a point, Dabo Swinney?
To some degree, but I think he's got to acknowledge that they're a victim of their own success. Are they not? I think a year ago after we saw them and what they did and how they dismantled Alabama, you know, we became conditioned to think it's easy. I remember standing on the sideline in pregame warm-up with Dabo Swinney versus South Carolina. He said, you know what? Our entire season has been defined by 8 bad throws, which all occurred within the first 4 or 5 weeks of the season. I get that. I see it. But the bottom line is he's got to keep the team hungry. Dealing with success sometimes can be harder than dealing with failure, so make them fear failure right now.
And this is the full transformation of Dabo Swinney into Nick Saban, the man who he has been chasing throughout all of this and now stares eye to eye with, because that's every bit of the rat poisoned discussions that we've heard over the years. All these things that Nick has to use to motivate five stars that Dabo is now finding out, especially when you have played this schedule, because to quote Creed, can you take me higher than 3 in this situation? LSU and Ohio State have played better teams through the course of the season. They're ranked and respected by the people they need to, maybe the national media not as much.
Mike, you know what's so interesting about this is if you go back to Selection Day, and the question wasn't who are the four that are in. The question was, who should be number one, which was then followed by, because you want to avoid Clemson in the semifinals. You know what that tells me? Clemson's the number one team in the country. So from that perspective, Dabo Swinney and his football team have garnered more than enough respect, because when that's the conversation that's being had, that tells you who's number one.
That's fair. It also means we'd rather play the 4 seed than the 3, because the gap between the top 3 and the 4 is certainly substantial. My contention with Clemson, certainly it's not who you play. It should be how you play. And we started to turn the page on Clemson a handful of games in, going, look, we know they're going to dominate everybody. It's like you're the kid that behaves the best. You don't have to pay attention to that kid. So we didn't have to watch Clemson football because we assumed they were going to dominate. In some respects, that's the most complimentary thing you could attribute to Clemson football.
Exactly. Some of it is how we consume. Like, they didn't have a ranked game for us to speak of, really, after that North Carolina game that people treated like a loss, so you had no reason to look back over there until the ACC championship game. And by then, they'd rattled off however many straight 40-point wins.
Yeah. Well, all I know is they play good in big games.
Yes.
At the end of the day, They play their best in big games.
The ACC was what it was this season. They couldn't control their schedule.
Right.
They could control who they scheduled in the non-con, but can't control how good those teams are. And Clemson certainly has been good enough to make the playoff more often than not, and certainly one of the favorites to win it all. Now, Clemson and all four college football playoff teams represented on the AP All-American teams. Not necessarily on the first team, though. You see LSU, their breakout offensive season, landing two first-team All-Americans in the AP, and Joe Burrow, Ja'Marr Chase. You see Jonathan Taylor, Chuba Hubbard, both first and second in rushing yards this season with the running back selection. Outland Trophy winner Penei Sewell highlights a very deep offensive line. Defensive side of the ball, playoff teams represented as well. Ohio State lands Chase Young, Jeffrey Okuda. Clemson has their only first-team All-American and Butkus Award winner Isaiah Simmons, and LSU with Derek Stingley Jr., the only freshman to make the first team. For the first time in 9 years, Alabama did not have a player named first-team All-Americans. Cornerback Trayvon Diggs was a third-teamer. Head coach Nick Saban confirmed on Monday that Diggs, along with linebacker Terrell Lewis, will not play in the bowl game against Michigan. Saban says each player has a decision to make based on the information they have, although some of that information can be misleading.
Do you guys actually pick guys in the draft? Does the media pick guys? Do the guys that put the mock drafts up, do you guys actually have a draft choice? Do you pick the people that pick? I'm not sure we do have anybody in that position. We've had guys that they put, we're going to get drafted in the first round, and got drafted in the fifth round. I don't think all that information is exactly accurate. I actually think that the NFL teams try to steer the media away from who they're going to pick and who they like. All right, so there's a lot of misinformation out there as to who the guys are. I'm excited about the guys that are playing in the game, the guys that have decided to play in the game, and I think all the guys that are playing in the game have made really good choices to play in the game, and I think they can enhance their value by playing in the game very, very well.
Nick Saban should stay tuned. We got Todd McShay's mock draft coming up for the first round in just a little bit. We've got Jerry Jeudy, Henry Ruggs III, Devontae Smith. They've all said we're going to play. I think most the draft eligible guys are going to play. To the guys that aren't, let me ask you this, Mike. Which players should not play in a bowl game?
If you've maxed out your value and you've got a legitimate fear of injury, maybe there's injury history built into this. If we had a healthy,
like a Terrell Lewis,
if we had a Tua Tagovailoa who could play in a bowl game, who still had the injury history he did, I look at it and say, if you've maxed out your value and we're playing not in a game that doesn't matter, but in a game that's not going to net us a national championship, I was never in that position. But as a teammate, I'd be the first one lining up to tell you, hey man, be careful and make the right decision, because we all know what's at stake now, and it's a lot more than ever before.
Mike, I'm really glad you made a separation between a player who's had a history of injury and players who are just making this decision, because here's the problem with this decision. Players look at this backwards. The likelihood that you are going to play in a game and come out healthy is 20 times more likely than it is that you're going to get injured. They look at it the other way around.
Significantly injured.
Significantly injured.
Yeah.
How many times do we practice? How many times do we play? How many times do we walk off that field? And what Nick Saban essentially is cryptically saying right there is, start listening to the people that matter when you're going to make this decision. Listen to me. Listen to GMs. When you get your NFL paperwork back, that's not coming from people that don't count. Listen to the people that matter. And I think what he gets concerned about is, there are too many voices in the ears of a lot of these guys, and a lot of them don't have the right information. Just listen to the right people is what he's warning his players against.
Now, and that's all fair, but you also have coaches who make business decisions as well, saying, I'm taking a new job, and I'm not going to coach my former team in the bowl game. So we talk about the importance of these last games and seeing it through. Coaches make business decisions all of the time, so it's hard to fault kids for taking it upon themselves to take their own future in their own hands.
I won't ever fault the kid who makes a personal decision for himself and what he believes is the betterment of his well-being and his family's future. You got one responsibility first and foremost, and it's take care of you and yours in that regard. And some coaches are making business decisions the other way. Remember, Herm Edwards last year was one that said, we talked to N'Keal Harry, who ended up being a first-round pick for them, a wide receiver, and we said, with him and his family, we all came to the decision that it was in his best interest not to play in that final game, not to be a part of this. And so there are coaches, I'm sure, from a recruiting standpoint, that are going to be able to turn around and say, look, when we're signing your son, we have his best interest in mind when it comes to his future.
Yeah. No question.
Turn away, Nick Saban. We've got a mock draft to show you from someone who isn't drafting teams. Todd McShay does have a handful of Alabama Crimson Tide there in the first round. Three receivers in all, an offensive tackle, two defensive players, all projected to be first round. You see Judy Tagovailoa, Ruggs, Raekwon Davis is there as well. Oh, you see Xavier McKinney. Look at this talent.
Hey, listen, they all need to play because that's my bowl game, and I want to see the best of the best, baby.
Yes.
And Michigan, I don't want to hear any nonsense out of you either.
Yeah. Michigan had guys sit out last year. They're probably hoping some of these guys take a page from their handbook last year. Tua Tagovailoa, who would become the first Bama quarterback since 1976 to be drafted in the first round of the NFL draft, obviously projected as a first rounder as well. Tua was the number one dual threat quarterback in the class of 2017. Most of the class of 2020 signs on the dotted line on Wednesday. We'll have a look ahead to the early signing period and the race for number one. We know who's in the playoff. We're going to find out who's in the fold in these early signing classes coming up on Wednesday. Last year, nearly 76% of the top 300 recruits signed in that early window, up nearly 13% from the previous year. That was able to solidify the top 10 rankings as four SEC schools were ranked inside the top 10 after December and stayed there until the final rankings. Matt Schick, National Recruiting Director Tom Luganville, along with Mike Golic Jr., third iteration here for the early signing period. How has that changed recruiting, coming from a guy who's covered this for 15 years?
Well, it has certainly put the coaches in a position to have to be far more prepared. I think the first time around, they were a little bit surprised at how serious the kids were going to take it and how many kids were going to actually do it. Now they know that we can pretty much remove the term early and just call this the signing period. In fact, I'm calling the one in February the residual signing period because ultimately that's what it ends up being. And so I think what coaches have done more than anything else is once they get the hay in the barn, now they can really map out the next 6 weeks. Maybe it's just three guys they got to focus on. Maybe it's two. Maybe it's none. Now you get a head start. And then what it's done is it's helped, I think, the group of five schools. Because the group of five schools now know what the player pool is. Some of those kids that might have been fringe kids have realized, wait a minute, there wasn't a spot for me. Now I need to start making the group of five selection.
Exactly. And I think that was the goal from the start, was to clarify the picture, because you're right. The exhaustion, and we all are covering bowl games,
yeah.
And you see these coaches. That first year, coaches were exhausted. They were flying all over the country. And now there's a sense of relief in saying, when we get our work done and we sign the majority of our class, for the rest of the staff, life becomes easier post-bowl game when you get to start looking, again, towards that last bit of your group, but really getting a head start on the rest of your offseason program.
Less babysitting for these
Absolutely.
Coaches. And two fewer months for, like you said, group of five schools to have their programs paid perhaps poached by those
no
larger
question.
Programs. When you think about these classes here, we had a recent update in the ESPN class rankings. Clemson has now surged to number one with a few five stars there. It has been a remarkable occurrence there with Clemson at number one. What do you attribute that to?
The premium positions that have committed to Clemson. You know, there's four of them. Offensive line, defensive corner, and quarterback. When you look at Clemson's class and you look at where their highest rated players are, it is a staggering class in the defensive front. Now, how has Clemson been built? They've been built from the inside out, right? That's how they've become dominant. That's how they've beat an Alabama. That's how they have been able to get their program to this level. So now that they're in the driver's seat, they've become the destination for those types of players. Also helped getting Trenton Simpson's verbal commitment. You take a look at this. This is just Clemson's defensive and offensive line class. You see the running back there in DeMarcus Bowman. But look at the number rank of the position. All in one class. So that's the reason right now Clemson sits where they sit.
It's remarkable. And you look at what Clemson, this is going to be the highest. Obviously, you can't go any higher than one, but this is the latest that they have been this high in terms of class ranking. So certainly the whole narrative and underdog nature, that's in the rearview mirror now for Clemson.
It is. And you see that kind of depth year after year is what separates the teams that are competing for national championships and not. Was it the last seven national champions are averaging a top 10
six of the last seven, yeah.
Every four, in the 4 years leading up to that, usually top five classes in the 2 years leading up to a national championship. It's creating depth, especially along the lines of scrimmage. And I think you go to the Nick Saban teams that were dominant even at the end of the BCS era. Yeah. It was now during that time, that break in between the end of the season and the playoff, being able to build that depth back up, get guys healthy, allows you to go out and roll bodies through in these playoff games and play so free like
that. The early signing period is great for programs like that. Let's get the hay in the barn and move on. It can be a huge challenge for coaches that just got hired. You get hired in December. You got 10 days at the most to try and cobble together a signing class. Florida State, Missouri, just to name a couple.
Yeah, Arkansas, Rutgers, Greg Schiano. You look at some of these coaches, Lane Kiffin, Mike Norvell. Listen, they're up against it. You're evaluating personnel. You're on an airplane. You're in a hotel. You're getting face-to-face. You're having to see if the guys that are currently committed are guys that you want to keep. What can you add? How much can you get done in a short period of time? Then what's going to happen for these guys is the 2.5-week dead period is going to occur. Give them a chance to round out their coaching staff, take a couple of deep breaths, hit the ground running, and hopefully make some significant strides in January.
I was a part of coaching change. I got to Notre Dame. Charlie Weiss is the head coach. Yep. Brian Kelly takes over. You are going to be judged, and you know this and have said as much. You're judged by the following year's recruiting class when you have a chance to get out there. And so your job now is to take that in conjunction with who's already on campus, go and make sure your message is delivered clearly, and start laying that foundation in the offseason program. So as you get a jump start on next year's recruiting, kids are coming in and seeing, this is the way that we're going to do business. This is what you can expect when you walk into our program.
You'd better crush that first full class. You better crush that next year.
Right.
Willie Taggart, Chad Morris had one full recruiting cycle before they were camped.
And Chad Morris, his first recruiting cycle was very strong. A lot of those
he
true freshmen got on the field. And I think that two classes come to mind for me in terms of first full calendar year. North Carolina with Mack Brown and Jeff Collins at Georgia Tech. And you say, well, why is that? Well, you get a full calendar year with your staff to lay down your blueprint and execute it. Look at this North Carolina class. Both Desmond Evans and Miles Murphy are from the state of North Carolina. That has been a very difficult state to put a fence around because there's good football, there's good players, and it's not what I would call an allegiance state. When you come out of the womb, you say, I'm a North Carolina kid or I'm a Wake kid. So you got to win guys over and then ward off all the suitors. And I think the job that Jeff Collins, now you talk about a complete roster overhaul. In his first full calendar year, I think it's going to be really, really strong come the end of Wednesday.
We're going to talk to Jeff Collins and Mack Brown coming up on our Wednesday coverage of National Signing Day. Scott Satterfield has certainly hit the ground running as well. Even if you have a short window to recruit, you can show some signs of that in your first season as head coach, and having that success certainly has benefited Louisville. We'll see if they can hold on to all of their recruits coming up on National Signing Day. And then we got bowl season to think about. Buffalo takes on Charlotte in the Makers Wanted Bahamas Bowl at 2 o'clock Eastern on ESPN, otherwise known as Greg McElroy's company paid Christmas gift.
And I'm not there, by the way.
You are not, and there's a reason for that.
Why trail?
I know.
Button your shirt. And then at 7:30 on ESPN2, Battle of Quarterbacks, Jordan Love leads Utah State against Dustin Crum and Kent State. The Tropical Smoothie Cafe Frisco Bowl, both games live on the ESPNF, so you can watch anywhere. Up next, it was a speech still resonating days later. We'll look back at Joe Burrow's emotional Heisman moment.
Coming from Southeast Ohio, it's a very impoverished area, and the poverty rate is almost two times the national average, and there's so many people there that don't have a lot.
College football playoff semifinals December 28th on ESPN, the ESPN app. Heisman winner Joe Burrow, number one LSU facing Oklahoma in the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl at 4 Eastern, 1 Pacific. Then it's number two Ohio State, number three Clemson in the PlayStation Fiesta Bowl. The winners play for the national championship Monday, January 13th on ESPN. Joe Burrow trying to become the first Heisman winner to win the national championship in the college football playoff era. Joe Burrow set records on the field and then set records in the Heisman voting. And while him winning it was a foregone conclusion, the magnitude of the moment was not lost on the winner.
Coming from Southeast Ohio, it's a very, very impoverished area, and the poverty rate is almost two times the national average, and there's so many people there that don't have a lot. And I'm up here for all those kids in Athens and in Athens County that, you know, go home to not a lot of food on the table, hungry after school, You guys can be up here too. Coach O, you have no idea what you mean to my family. You know, I didn't play for 3 years. You took a chance on me, not knowing if I could play or not. And I'm forever in your... forever grateful for you. Can you imagine a guy like Coach O giving me the keys to his football program? He just means so much to me and my family. And to LSU, I sure hope they give him a lifetime contract. He deserves it.
Quite a scene Saturday night in New York. I asked Joe Burrow on ESPN Radio right after he won the award. It seemed like inevitable. You were going to win. You had weeks to think about this, yet you were so emotional. Why? And he said, it wasn't until I got up on stage you started thinking about all the people that have helped you get to this moment. You saw the emotions there on full display.
A lot of emotions, but he still understood the platform that he had, and you heard him bring up something near and dear to him, the poverty in Southeast Ohio, where he's from, Athens County, and because he understood that, there was a call and there was a response. There was a fundraiser started not long after that for the Athens County Food Pantry online. Since that speech, they have raised about $377,000 to help feed